When E.F. Schumacher published Small is Beautiful in 1973, he couldn't have anticipated its explosive impact. The book would become a cornerstone of environmental economics, selling over 1 million copies and being translated into 27 languages. Named by the Times Literary Supplement as one of the 100 most influential books published since World War II, it found admirers ranging from Jimmy Carter to the Dalai Lama. What made this book so revolutionary? Schumacher dared to challenge the very foundations of modern economics at the height of industrial expansion, arguing that our obsession with growth, size, and technological complexity was leading humanity toward catastrophe. His work arrived at a pivotal moment, just as the 1973 oil crisis was revealing the fragility of resource-dependent economies and offered an alternative vision that still resonates powerfully today. One of our age's most perilous misconceptions is the belief that the problem of production has been solved. This fallacy, embraced by economists worldwide, blinds us to our rapid consumption of irreplaceable capital. Modern industrial society positions itself outside nature, seeking to dominate rather than exist within it. Our technological achievements have created the illusion of unlimited power and resources. The fundamental error lies in our failure to distinguish between income and capital when dealing with natural resources. We treat fossil fuels, undeniably capital items, as income, maximizing their extraction rather than conserving them. We project absurd future consumption figures, planning to triple fuel usage without acknowledging these resources are finite and irreplaceable. Beyond fossil fuels, we're depleting two other critical capital reserves: nature's tolerance margins and the human substance itself. The post-war industrial explosion has introduced synthetic compounds unknown to nature, against which she has no defense. These accumulate with dangerous and unpredictable consequences. Nuclear energy merely shifts the problem, creating ecological hazards of monstrous proportions. Consider the stark disparities in resource consumption. The rich use 14 times more fuel per capita than the poor. If current growth patterns continue, world fuel consumption would quadruple by 2000, with wealthy nations accounting for two-thirds of this increase despite being only 23% of the global population. Such consumption is implausible given our finite fossil fuel reserves. The rich are essentially stripping the world of its once-for-all endowment of relatively cheap fuels, creating inevitable resource conflicts. Environmental hazards would reach unprecedented levels, whether from radioactive nuclear materials or thermal pollution. Economic growth, unlimited from technological perspectives, inevitably hits environmental bottlenecks. Materialism contains no limiting principle while existing in a strictly limited environment. What's the path forward? We need a profound reorientation of science and technology toward the organic, gentle, nonviolent, elegant, and beautiful. We require methods and equipment that are cheap enough to be accessible to virtually everyone, suitable for small-scale application, and compatible with human creativity. Economics occupies a central position in modern society, providing the criteria of what is economic or uneconomic, judgments that influence individual, group, and government actions more than any other factor. These judgments have become so deeply embedded in our decision-making processes that they shape everything from personal purchasing choices to national policy decisions. Yet these judgments are fragmentary, considering only monetary profit while ignoring broader social, aesthetic, moral, and political dimensions that contribute to human well-being and societal progress. The economic calculus favors short-term thinking, excludes free goods like the natural environment, treats all goods according to market value rather than intrinsic worth, and institutionalizes individualism and non-responsibility. For instance, a corporation might find it more economical to pollute a river and pay fines than to properly dispose of waste, despite the long-term environmental and social costs. The market suppresses vital qualitative distinctions, reducing everything to price and exchangeability, treating fundamentally different categories of goods, primary non-renewable resources like oil and minerals, primary renewable resources such as forests and fisheries, manufactured goods from cars to computers, and services from healthcare to entertainment as equivalent based solely on price. This approach fails to recognize the incommensurability between these categories, applying theories developed for manufacturers indiscriminately across all goods. When economics attempts to measure the immeasurable through cost-benefit analysis, it absurdly reduces higher values to the level of the lower. Consider how we might value a historic neighborhood. While developers see only potential real estate profits, residents value their community connections, cultural heritage, and sense of place, aspects that defy monetary quantification. Have you ever wondered why we value a plastic toy more than clean air? It's because the toy has a price tag, while the air, until polluted, is free. This distortion of values leads to bizarre situations where destroying irreplaceable natural capital can be considered economic if it generates short-term profit. The Amazon rainforest provides a stark example. Its value as cleared farmland appears on balance sheets, while its crucial role in global climate regulation, biodiversity preservation, and indigenous cultures' survival remains economically invisible. Economics operates legitimately only within a framework derived from meta-economics, the study of man and his environment, but becomes destructive when it transgresses these boundaries. A truly rational economic system would distinguish between renewable and non-renewable resources, between production that enhances human dignity and that which degrades it, between growth that builds community and growth that destroys it. This would mean developing new metrics beyond GDP, incorporating measures of environmental health, social cohesion, and human well-being. Some countries, like Bhutan with its Gross National Happiness Index and New Zealand with its well-being budget, are pioneering such approaches, demonstrating that alternative economic frameworks are possible and practical. Buddhist economics represents a fundamentally different approach to economic life, rooted in the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path requirement of right livelihood. Unlike modern economics, which treats work as a necessary evil and consumption as life's purpose, Buddhist economics views work as essential to human development, personal growth, and societal well-being. The contrast between modern and Buddhist economic perspectives can be illustrated through their divergent views on work and purpose. In modern economics, work is seen as a burden to be minimized, something we endure solely to earn money for consumption. This manifests in the relentless pursuit of automation, downsizing, and the glorification of leisure. Buddhist economics, conversely, sees work as an integral part of human flourishing, providing opportunities for creativity, skill development, and meaningful contribution to community. A craftsperson perfecting their trade or a farmer cultivating land mindfully exemplifies this perspective. Local production for local needs stands as a cornerstone of Buddhist economic thinking. This approach prioritizes community self-reliance and environmental sustainability over global trade networks. For instance, rather than shipping food thousands of miles, a Buddhist economist would advocate for local farming and distribution systems that connect nearby producers and consumers. This not only reduces environmental impact, but strengthens community bonds and economic resilience. The modern trend of increasing long-distance trade and complex supply chains would be viewed not as progress, but as a sign of systemic inefficiency and disconnection. The Buddhist approach to resource management sharply diverges from modern economic theory. While conventional economics reduces everything to monetary values, Buddhist economics recognizes fundamental distinctions between different types of resources. Renewable resources, like sustainable forestry or solar energy, are preferred over non-renewable ones. The Buddhist perspective demands special reverence for living systems. Forests aren't merely timber sources, but complex ecosystems deserving protection. This extends to all sentient beings, promoting an economics of stewardship rather than exploitation. The use of non-renewable resources, particularly fossil fuels, represents a critical concern in Buddhist economics. Their extraction and consumption are seen as depleting Earth's finite capital rather than living within its natural income. This perspective warns that such practices inevitably lead to environmental degradation and social conflict. Recent examples of resource-driven conflicts and environmental disasters validate these concerns. The rush to modernize without spiritual and ethical foundations has led to documented cases of rural displacement, urban poverty, and environmental destruction in many developing regions. Buddhist economics offers a middle way, a balanced path between unbridled materialism and rigid traditionalism. This approach advocates for technological advancement and economic development that align with spiritual values and environmental stewardship. It suggests that genuine progress must integrate material well-being with spiritual development, environmental preservation, and social harmony. This might mean embracing appropriate technology, promoting meaningful work opportunities, and developing economic systems that serve human needs without destroying natural systems or community fabric. The question of scale impacts our entire social structure. Before mass transport and communications, structure existed naturally because people were relatively immobile. Now, with unprecedented mobility, all structures are vulnerable. Economics has consumed almost all government attention while becoming increasingly impotent. The simplest tasks from 50 years ago now seem impossible. This pathological development stems partly from modern transport and communications technology. While these create trivial freedoms, they simultaneously destroy deeper freedoms by making everything vulnerable unless conscious policies mitigate their destructive effects. These impacts hit largest countries hardest, creating megalopolis in wealthy nations alongside growing populations of dropouts and crime, while in poor countries causing mass migration to cities, unemployment, and rural decay. Consider Lima, Peru, which grew from 175,000 people in the 1920s to nearly 3 million by the early 1970s, with rural migrants arriving at 1,000 daily, creating slums and overwhelming social systems. Similarly, small nations absorbed into larger economic unions inevitably see their capitals reduced to provincial cities and their cultures marginalized. The viability question isn't about states or nations, but about people. Combining non-viable people into larger communities doesn't make them viable, nor does dividing viable communities make people non-viable. The rich rarely subsidize the poor. They typically exploit them through trade terms while resisting secession attempts. What's the solution? Regionalism, developing all regions within countries rather than combining states into free trade systems, represents today's most crucial geographical challenge. The conventional economic wisdom invariably favors the already powerful, promoting development near capital cities, large projects over small ones, and capital-intensive over labor-intensive approaches. We need an entirely new economic system, focused on people rather than goods, production by the masses rather than mass production. Democracy, freedom, and human dignity are about people, who can only truly be themselves in small, comprehensible groups. Our economic thinking must address human realities like poverty, alienation, and spiritual death, or we must start afresh. Throughout history, civilizations have risen, flourished, and declined across the same lands, suggesting that material resource depletion cannot fully explain their fall. History and experience demonstrate that mankind, not nature, provides the primary resource. Economic development springs from human minds. When civilizations advance, we witness simultaneous outbursts of daring, initiative, and invention across multiple fields, sustained through education. Education is therefore our most vital resource. Yet modern education suffers from a profound metaphysical crisis. Dominant 19th century ideas, evolution, competition, class struggle, psychoanalysis, relativism, share a common reductionism, explaining higher phenomena as nothing but manifestations of the lower. Man becomes merely an accidental collocation of atoms, cultural achievements nothing but economic greed or sexual frustrations. These ideas, mere intellectual exercises to their originators, have become the very instruments through which later generations experience reality. They've seeped into our minds during our dark ages of early development, making the world seem like a meaningless wasteland where consciousness is an unfortunate cosmic accident and despair the only reality. Education cannot help us while it denies metaphysics. Whether teaching science or humanities, if it doesn't clarify our fundamental convictions, it cannot truly educate. The problem isn't specialization, but lack of depth and metaphysical awareness. Sciences are taught without examining their presuppositions. Economics without acknowledging its implicit view of human nature. Politics without exploring metaphysical roots. Have you ever wondered why brilliant scientists sometimes make poor judgments about human affairs? Darwin himself lamented how his scientific mind had atrophied his capacity for poetry, art, and music, a loss of happiness potentially injurious to intellect and moral character. This impoverishment will overwhelm civilization if we continue extending positive science to social facts through reductionism. True education produces whole persons connected to the center, their basic convictions about life's meaning and purpose. This center requires an orderly system of ideas about oneself and the world. To create such order, we must consciously accept metaphysical ideas opposite to inherited 19th century thinking, recognizing hierarchical levels of being that make the world intelligible, acknowledging that we think in opposites, and distinguishing between convergent problems, solvable by logic, and divergent problems of life that require higher forces like love to reconcile opposites. Among material resources, land is unquestionably the greatest, carrying the topsoil that sustains all life, including humans. Man must conform to natural laws or destroy the environment that sustains him, causing his civilization to decline. The confusion around land use persists as long as land and creatures are viewed merely as factors of production. Before being means to ends, they are ends in themselves, meta-economic and, in a sense, sacred. It is irrational for man to treat things he has not made, cannot make, and cannot recreate once spoiled in the same manner as things of his own making. Modern man, paradoxically defining himself as nothing but a naked ape or an accidental collocation of atoms, treats animals as machines, while traditional cultures recognize that man's superiority demands greater compassion toward animals. As Proverbs states, the just man takes care of his beast, and St. Thomas Aquinas observed that compassion for animals fosters compassion for fellow humans. The same principles apply to the land itself. Where traditional teachings about caring for the generous earth were heeded, civilizations flourished. Where ignored, they collapsed. Today's danger comes from applying industrial principles to agriculture, exemplified by the Mansholt Plan, which treats farming as just another industry to be rationalized through consolidation and population reduction. But agriculture fundamentally differs from industry. It deals with life and living substances, while industry seeks to eliminate the living factor in favor of predictable mechanisms. Agriculture is primary, while industry is secondary. Human civilization requires both in balance. This balance is destroyed when agriculture is treated merely as another industry. As metropolitan life breaks down psychologically, economically, and biologically, we should be reconstructing rural culture rather than accelerating the drift from agriculture. Instead of pursuing economic efficiency alone, we must orient agriculture toward the threefold ideal of health, beauty, and permanence, following nature's laws of return, diversification against monoculture, and decentralization to use local resources. modern technology has become inhuman, recognizing no self-limiting principles in terms of size, speed, or violence. Unlike nature, which knows when to stop growing, technology lacks self-balancing mechanisms, acting like a foreign body in nature's subtle system. This has triggered three simultaneous crises: human revolt against suffocating technological patterns, environmental breakdown, and rapid depletion of non-renewable resources. Our consumer society behaves like a drug addict, finding it extremely difficult to get off the hook. The rich countries, not the poor, are the problem children of the world. The poor cannot successfully adopt our technology, leading to mass unemployment, urban migration, rural decay, and social tensions. What they need, what we all need, is technology with a human face that makes human hands and brains more productive rather than redundant. As Gandhi said, the poor cannot be helped by mass production, only by production by the masses. Mass production is inherently violent, ecologically damaging, self-defeating in resource use, and stultifying for humans. By contrast, intermediate technology, vastly superior to primitive technology but simpler than super technology, is decentralized, ecologically compatible, gentle with scarce resources, and serves humans rather than making them servants of machines. Think about how differently you feel using a simple hand tool versus operating an automated machine. The former engages your creativity and skill. The latter reduces you to a button pusher. Now multiply this difference across entire societies, and you begin to understand why technological choices matter profoundly for human dignity and fulfillment. We face a conflict between two attitudes: the forward stampede people, who believe we must complete modern technology despite its problems, and the homecomers, who seek to redirect technology toward human needs and natural harmony. The homecomers find guidance in spiritual wisdom like the Beatitudes, which remind us we are poor, not demigods, need gentleness where small is beautiful, must pursue justice, and become peacemakers. The case for hope rests on ordinary people supporting pioneering minority groups like the Soil Association in agriculture and the Intermediate Technology Development Group in industry. Both demonstrate viable alternatives that reintegrate humans into production processes. Redirecting technology toward human needs requires primarily imagination and abandonment of fear. As Tawney observed, no system can prevent human egotism or greed, but it can create an environment where these qualities aren't encouraged. Today, we face not just social malaise, but ecological collapse threatening human survival. All economic systems reflect our basic outlook on life's meaning and purpose. The modern private enterprise system, powered by greed and envy, has been the most perfect instrument for personal enrichment, though modified by Keynesian management and trade unions. But such a system cannot possibly address our current problems, as greed demands continuous growth incompatible with a finite environment. Regarding ownership, we must distinguish between property that aids creative work and property that substitutes for it. The former, the working proprietor's property, is natural and healthy. The latter, the passive owner living parasitically, is unhealthy. Private enterprise with the first category is small-scale, personal, and local, carrying enormous social utility without creating great fortunes. Scale is decisive. In medium-scale enterprises, ownership becomes increasingly disconnected from work and therefore exploitative. High profits should be shared with all organization members, not appropriated solely by owners. Impersonal relationships in larger organizations require systematic communication and participation systems to preserve human dignity. In large-scale enterprises, private ownership becomes an absurdity, not property in any real sense, but rather property for acquisition, exploitation, or power. It resembles feudal dues that robbed peasants until the revolution abolished them. The Scott Bader Commonwealth offers a fascinating example of alternative ownership. This chemical company transformed itself into a commonwealth where workers share ownership and profits are divided between reinvestment, employee benefits, and charitable causes. The organization recognized four equally important tasks: economic, securing profitable orders; technical, maintaining up-to-date product design; social, providing satisfaction and development for members; and political, encouraging societal change through economic health and social responsibility. Despite its success, demonstrating that the Christian way of life in business brings good results in relationships and production quality, Scott Bader remains a small island of sanity in a large society ruled by greed and envy. While established businesses resist change, such examples remain valuable for the next generation seeking alternatives to conventional ownership models. Modern man has built a production system that ravishes nature and a society that mutilates humanity. The prevailing belief is that more wealth solves everything. Money can buy, circumvent, or compensate for any non-material values. Production and wealth acquisition have become our highest goals, with all others subordinate. This materialist philosophy now faces challenge not just from traditional wisdom, but from physical events themselves, speaking through terrorism, genocide, pollution, and exhaustion. We live in a unique convergence where the ancient message, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God," carries both promise and threat. Unless we prioritize correctly, even material necessities will become unavailable. We cannot control destructive forces merely by mobilizing more resources. What's needed is a fundamental revision of ends, developing a lifestyle where material things occupy their proper secondary place. The logic of production must be subordinated to the logic of life and society. Neither terrorism, pollution, resource depletion, nor wealth inequality can be addressed while we lack the concept that enough is good and more than enough is evil. Encouragingly, awareness of these deeper issues is gradually emerging in official circles, recognizing the need for moral choices and questioning conventional values. The solution lies not in discovering new truths, but in recovering ancient ones. From Christian tradition, the four cardinal virtues offer profound guidance: prudentia, clear-eyed objectivity achieved through contemplative silence; justitia, relating to truth; fortitudo, relating to goodness; and temperentia, knowing when enough is enough. The economics of permanence must become our focus. Nothing makes economic sense unless it can continue without absurdities. Small-scale operations are less harmful to nature than large-scale ones. Work must be humanized rather than treated as an inhuman chore to be abolished by automation. The neglect of wisdom has gone so far that most intellectuals have no idea what the term means. Wisdom can be found only inside oneself after liberating from greed and envy. Without wisdom, man builds monster economies that destroy the world while seeking fantastic satisfactions. When people ask what they can actually do, the answer is simple yet challenging. Each must put their own inner house in order, guided not by science or technology, but by mankind's traditional wisdom. The realism that dismisses these virtues as vague while pursuing wealth and power has been aptly called crackpot realism. Perhaps the most revolutionary act in our time is to insist that enough is enough, that quality matters more than quantity, and that human scale is the only scale at which we can truly flourish.